Next case on the court's calendar this morning is Stephen Moore versus City of New Brighton. We're ready for arguments when counsel is ready. At that time, would counsel for appellant please approach the podium, introduce yourself for the record, and begin your argument.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Lucas Castor, and I represent the appellant, Sergeant Steve Moore, who's seated in the back of the courtroom with us today. There are several issues before the court on this appeal, but there is fundamentally only really one issue. And that issue is whether the district court erred when it found that that no reasonable jury could find that the City of New Brighton retaliated against Sergeant Moore for his protected union grievance. In finding for the city, the district court made three fundamental errors that warrant reversal. First, the court overlooked and bypassed the key distinctions between Title VII and the Minnesota Whistleblower Act, and overlooked how the 2013 amendments to the Minnesota Whistleblower Act altered the inquiry for what qualifies as an adverse employment action under the Act. Two, when the court analyzed the alleged adverse acts, it did so in isolation. It viewed the facts for each of the alleged acts or alleged adverse acts in a vacuum, ignoring all of the other circumstances and acts that occurred over the 12 months between March of 2015 and 2016, thereby missing the cumulative impact of the city's repeated and continuous efforts to discipline Sergeant Moore. Third, when the court reached the ultimate question of causation and pretext, the court ignored all of the evidence that it had improperly dismissed regarding the adverse acts, for example, the reassignment, the coaching and counseling, and instead viewed a small subsect of the evidence and did so largely in the city's favor, drawing inferences in the city's favor. When the court views the evidence as a whole and properly finds that from a cumulative standpoint, that the actions taken by the city between March of 2015 and March of 2016, all of which were adverse employment actions when viewed as a whole, and when all the reasonable inferences are drawn in Mr. Moore's favor, the court should find that a triable issue existed.
Both of those, the last two issues are really one and the same, aren't they? I'm trying to distinguish between the two.
The issue regarding the adverse act, I'm just trying to understand.
Well, you said there's three issues. The three reasons why, I thought the last two reasons were essentially one and the same, that there's this cumulative effect, and the cumulative evidence reviewed in the light most favorable to your client would prevent the summary judgment and allow for trial.
The third issue is slightly different. It's saying when the court found, so the court in its order found that the reassignment, for example, the coaching and counseling did not meet the materiality standard under the Minnesota Whistleblower Act. When it did the ultimate analysis of causation and pretext, it didn't even consider that evidence which it had dismissed regarding the reassignment and the coaching and counseling. It just entirely ignored it. And even if the court found that the district court's decision regarding those specific alleged adverse acts was correct, it's still circumstantial evidence regarding pretext and causation that must be considered by the court. That's the third issue, is that the court didn't even consider it in a two-page sort of recitation regarding the analysis of pretext. The court only looked at the comparators and a very small subsect of the evidence, not considering the totality of the city's actions over the 12 months between March of 2015 and March of 2016.
Appellate courts, our court, many courts have consistently stated this broad proposition that the employment law, discrimination and retaliation laws are not intended to make the court the super human rights department. I haven't found cases that support the idea that reassigning a police officer, a sergeant, to some duties other than the duties that the officer began with amounts to an actionable adverse employment action under any of the various statutory bases, federal or state, for discrimination or retaliation claims.
And I think under the standard under now the Minnesota Whistleblower Act, under the penalized word of that statute, which is whether it would dissuade a reasonable employee under those circumstances. There are several cases that deal with reassignment by itself and not a reduction in title or pay or that still qualify to meet that dissuading standard. And one of them is the Burlington case, where the plaintiff in that case was reassigned from a forklift position to a position that had more arduous duties. There's also the I think it's SCARE, S-K-A-R-E, which is a District of Minnesota case. In that case, the court said even though there was no change in specific title or pay, there was a reduction in skill and supervisory duties that resulted from the reassignment. That's exactly what happened to Sergeant Moore in this case.
Was that a Minnesota Whistleblower Act case or some other?
It was not a Minnesota Whistleblower Act case. I think, if my recollection serves me, it was a Title VII retaliation.
And so that makes that case sort of an outlier when it comes to Title VII, where Title VII is almost universally rejects that theory.
Well, I think
that you have a sergeant assigned to patrol. The department says, okay, you know, we're going to reassign you to whatever, administrative sergeant, as in this case, or move you to a different shift. I think that's where courts have been cautious in saying, look, we're at some point there is an HR authority. There's discretion in HR to make these decisions and police chiefs to make these decisions. And at least as regard to that part of your claim, I don't know. I mean, you may find a case or two that stands for that proposition, but I think the overwhelming majority of cases cut the other way on that point.
Well, I think...
Am I right about that?
I don't know about the general... I mean, there are several cases. I mentioned Burlington and SCARE. There's the Eighth Circuit decision in Fisher, which references a salesperson's switch. So not a reduction in title, but a switch in territory was a material impact on the employee. It would dissuade a reasonable employee. And what the courts have said is that you must view all of the circumstances, whether a particular reassignment would always be an adverse employment action, depends on the circumstances in this case. And you can't view
At least on this point of the, I know you don't want to look at these things in isolation, but you kind of have to look at each one to determine whether or not there's a non-discriminatory, non-retaliatory reason. And in this case, there was a reassignment to a non-supervisory role, despite the title remaining sergeant, into an administrative role. But it's in the context of your client having been found to have violated the department's policy in a supervisory role. That is the approval of Sergeant Olson's time.
So and
that's a rational reason, isn't it, to say, you know, in this case, we're going to move you away from supervising individuals because we have found that in your supervision you have violated policy. So we're going to take that off the table for you.
That wasn't the rationale that the city put forth as to the reasons for the reassignment. The reasons that the city put forth for the reassignment were general performance issues over what it alleged to be a history of time. What we do know
but
is
one of
that...
One of those performance issues was the finding that your client did violate city policy.
There is no documentary evidence supporting that conclusion that was the reason that the city reassigned him.
No, but you were saying I thought you acknowledged that it's because of a history of alleged inappropriate supervisory services. That's one part of it, isn't it?
Well, the approval of overtime, sure, is one part of it, but there are also facts that suggest that wasn't really the reason why they did the reassignment. If that was an issue, for example, there are facts in the record that would suggest that the city knew long before his protected conduct in March of 2015 that they were aware that Sergeant Moore had been improving time. For example, every time one of his subordinates would work additional times, they would send an email to Ms. Forbord, who is a member of the management team, reporting the additional hours, and the simple fact that when people were working the additional hours, they were on duty. And so the supervisors who were on duty would know when their workers were working. And so there's an inference to be made when drawing it in Mr. Moore's favor that the city knew for a long time that Mr. Moore had been reporting or allowing his subordinates to work additional time, and the city did nothing until after March of 2015. And when that fact is combined with all of the other facts regarding the circumstances that happened, the 9 months of administrative leave, the failure to notify him at the conclusion of the second internal affairs investigation, the imposition of a counseling and guidance days after his return in 9 months, that only referenced conduct from 2012 and before, 4 years earlier. It had never happened before. And then he's reassigned to this position where he said, not only are we taking your supervisory duties away, now you basically aren't a cop anymore. You're overlooking policies, you're looking after vehicles. And oh, by the way, your office is gonna be right next to management so we can keep an eye on you throughout this process. And one of the things there is, with respect to the reassignment, one of the things that is referenced in the Kim and the Phillips case, which are the cases that stand for the proposition that even though each individual adverse act might not have to meet the materiality standard, if they're viewed in combination, in a cumulative effect, taken over a period of time, if the city is doing everything it can to try to dissuade Mr. Moore from engaging in the protected conduct that he did, one of the things in the Kim case was a surveillance of the employee. And in the record, it says that one of the reasons why Mr. Moore's office was moved is so that he can be directly connected to management and they can observe how he's performing. That's one of the things that the Kim case says, is that this ongoing surveillance is one of the things that could dissuade an employee when you view the circumstances in totality. Same thing with respect to the coaching and counseling. The court failed to understand that the Minnesota Whistleblower Act specifically enumerates discipline as an adverse employment action.
Now, adverse employment action is not actually in the statute, nor is it, frankly, in Title VII, but it's been incorporated by courts over time. I want you to focus for a moment on the legal theory of that you're making here, that there's some standard that is a variation of that under Minnesota's Whistleblower Act because of the way the statute defines the protected conduct. How much do those cases apply? That use that term in analyzing Title VII and other statutes that actually expressly say, or maybe vaguely say, you can't discriminate, but don't actually describe the protected conduct.
Sure. So I think you have to go back to the language of the Minnesota Whistleblower Act itself. And there are some specific enumerated prohibitions, discharge, discipline, threaten. The question regarding those additional cases and how they factor in really come to this analysis of otherwise discriminate and penalize. And so under Title VII, there is no penalize prohibition. It's just otherwise discriminate. And so the court's looking at when it's determining what is an adverse employment action, and that's where the Burlington standard applies. It's defining what applies under this otherwise discriminate term under Title VII. Under the Minnesota Whistleblower Act, we have different prohibitions than under Title VII. We also have this otherwise discriminate language, and then penalize, which the legislature in 2013 defined directly consistent with the Burlington Northern Standard and adopted that. And so what the courts have said, certainly the court can look to these cases for guidance, but a reduction in title and pay is not determinative of the ultimate decision about what qualifies as an adverse employment action. You have to look at the overall circumstances of this particular case. You know, would a reassignment from one desk to one that's 5 feet away always be an adverse employment action? Certainly not. But, you know, when you are talking about a reassignment regarding a change in fundamental duties from someone who is a trained law enforcement officer who no longer goes out on the street and performs the duties which he was trained and had trained for 25 years.
Just to put a finer point in your argument, your contention is that the term adverse employment action applies in all of these statutory settings, but it may have different meaning depending on the protected conduct referred to in the statute.
Correct. What the enumerated prohibitions are in the statute. But then when you get to the general prohibition of dissuading an employee, that really should apply across the board because that's the standard that applies under Title VII for this otherwise discriminate language, but also under the Minnesota Whistleblower Act for penalize. So there's two ways. For example, taking the coaching and counseling, there's reasonable facts in the record to say that it was discipline. and because an oral reprimand under the CBA is discipline, and the Minnesota Whistleblower Act specifically prevents discipline as a means of retaliation. And so there's a reasonable inference that that was discipline, and so that's an adverse employment action. But it also could qualify under the general penalize dissuading a reasonable employee standard under that as well. I see that I've 5 seconds left. I'd like to reserve the remainder of 5 minutes for my rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel, my name is Jana O'Leary Sullivan, and I represent the city of New Brighton in this case today.
Counsel, do you need to adjust the podium? You can take a moment to do it. We'll take.
There's a button in front.
There's a button in front.
Thank
and
you.
And we'll start
I appreciate the
clock again for you.
I know Judge Larkin, and that wasn't meant to be disparaging.
I can't see you.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Very good. Good. In this case, as you know, the district court granted summary judgment. And summary judgment is really appropriate for three reasons. And the first is that the plaintiff or the appellant's Minnesota whistleblower claim fails as a matter of law because the district court lacks summary subject matter jurisdiction over that claim because the appellant's claim essentially derives from the collective bargaining agreement. The second reason that this court should affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment is the appellant has not established pretext, and the third reason is that the appellant cannot establish a prima facie case at any level or any of the elements.
I'm going to start you with your first argument because I was a little confused about it. On subject matter jurisdiction, you acknowledge in your brief that a grievance can satisfy the statutory element, provided that it meets one of the requirements. Either it's a complaint about a violation of law, common law, or a rule adopted pursuant to law.
Your Honor, there's a couple different portions of it, and to the extent that I was confusing about that argument, the case law is a little bit confusing and conflates some of the concepts, so there isn't really a case that specifically addresses the issue. In many ways, this is a case of first impression.
Let me tee it up a different way.
Yep.
You acknowledge in your brief that a report of a violation of law in a grievance would not be outside the court's jurisdiction.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And in this case, one of the elements of a prima facie case is there has to be a report of a violation of law.
Correct. That is correct, Your Honor.
So why does the jurisdictional argument even matter? I don't understand why. If there is a report of a violation of law in the grievance, then the court has jurisdiction. If there's not, the court doesn't. But if there's not, there's also no prima facie case established.
Your Honor, the issue turns on whether the underlying claim that's in that grievance is derived from the collective bargaining agreement, and that is the critical inquiry. So in theory, you could have a case where somebody states, I was disciplined or terminated in violation of the collective bargaining agreement and because of some other factor that is prohibited by law, because of sex or race or sexual orientation or something like that, something that would clearly implicate another law. In this case, the appellant's argument is completely related and derived from and completely requires an interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement.
I thought the allegation was, in the grievance, that the city is responsible to, but did not, provide payment, compensation, as required by the collective bargaining agreement.
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
In other words, the city breached its contract.
There are two different elements, and one speaks to the overarching theme of whether the district court had some subject matter jurisdiction. There's another that did the, as part of the prima facie case, did the appellant establish that he engaged in protected activity. I would say that to the extent that you're saying that he's alleging a breach of contract, that is really speaking to the issue of does he establish a prima facie case by saying that he engaged in protected activity.
Well, it would apply to both. You've acknowledged that if there was a report of a violation of law, that there would be no subject matter jurisdiction issue, because the statute says you can make a claim of a violation of law, and that's protected. The statute now says, as recently amended, if you make a claim of a violation of common law, that also establishes if there's retaliation because of a report of a violation of common law, that also establishes a claim. So that also would be within the court's jurisdiction.
There's two separate arguments. The first is that in response to that an allegation that there is a breach of a collective bargaining agreement is a violation of law, and that is recognized by the Whistleblower Act. The word, while certainly the Whistleblower Act has been amended to include common law, you can't simply exchange or substitute the word contract for common law.
Why? Because what does common law mean? In the statute, it obviously, the legislature intended to add to the protection.
I agree.
Give me an example of a case, other than contract violations, breach of contract, that would meet the legislative intent in applying this term common law.
There are many other causes of action, as you know, recognized under common law. And in the employment world, some of the most common ones are there's a common law fraud or allegation or violation. There's also a common law whistleblower claim. And those are things that are, again, they're against the law and the common law, but it's completely separate from an analysis of whether it's a collective bargaining agreement.
Wouldn't a breach of contract be a violation of common law?
Your Honor, the way that the structure is in the scheme of the Minnesota Whistleblower Act, it is not interchangeable just to substitute. And I think that the rules of legislative intent and interpretation apply here. That obviously, as we all know, that in 2013, the legislature did make some significant changes to that. It could have very easily added the language contract, but did not do so.
No, it's broad. It's common law. And so you've acknowledged that a common law claim of a common law whistleblower claim would be cognizable under this statute as amended?
Not necessarily. I think the law is still really very clear. And I think also that speaks to the protective activity.
Well, give me an example. I still don't know of an example of a circumstance where common law would apply. If it's not under contract, give me an example.
I do believe that the common law fraud, if there was an allegation that somebody was committing fraud, that it was under the common law, not necessarily a specific statute.
Now, if the legislature wanted to limit it to common law fraud, it would have said common law fraud.
I would say that breach of contract is a cause of action that is recognized by common law, but is not necessarily a violation of common law, that we can't use those terms interchangeably. But I would say we don't even get to that issue in this case because fundamentally the plaintiff's or the appellant's claim is intertwined with an interpretation of that collective bargaining agreement. So we don't even get into the issue of whether the appellant has established a prima facie case.
Well, I'm going to take you to your prima facie case because I'd like to hear more argument on it. I'll just suggest to you, I'm not speaking on behalf of the court, but from my perspective, your subject matter jurisdiction argument is, I don't understand it. I don't find it especially compelling. So you might want to go turn to the other issue. But before you do so, the district court did not reach the violation of law theory under FALSA, the Fair Labor Standards Act. That is that Sergeant Moore filed a grievance that essentially says the city was failing under the Fair Labor Standards Act. That would be a violation of law. And the district court didn't need to reach it because of its analysis of common law. But that would be an alternative basis to agree with the district court that subject matter jurisdiction exists in this case, wouldn't it? Fair Labor Standards Act violation?
Your Honor, I would disagree that in this case, the plain language of that grievance, that the appellant was alleging that there was a violation of the collective bargaining agreement and did not make any indication that it violated the Fair Labor Standards Act.
Case law is really clear that you don't have to expressly say when the claim is based on a violation of law or the report is a violation of law, you don't have to say what the law is that's being violated. You might describe it in a number of different ways. Wouldn't you agree that at heart, the allegation that was made in the grievance is that the Fair Labor Standards Act is being violated by not affording the overtime pay that the sergeant claimed was his right?
Your Honor, I would agree that an appellant or an employee does not have to identify the statute, but what is clear, even after those 2013 amendments, is that the appellant or the employee has to establish facts that, if true, would at least implicate a violation of law. The Fair Labor Standards Act, as I cited especially in my reply brief or the fourth brief in this series, is that The appellant's entire argument was that he was entitled to overtime pay because it happened outside of his normal shift. The Fair Labor Standards Act does not care when work is done. It doesn't implicate in any way, shape, or form a violation of the Fair Labor Standards Act. And the appellant recognized that as they dismissed that FLSA claim even before the summary judgment stage.
They dismissed the FLSA claim, but they didn't dismiss, they didn't, I don't think they abandoned the theory that the grievance can be supported or the grievance was motivated by a colorable report of a violation of law and a violation of breach of the contract. I don't see whether it's under Fair Labor Standards Act or the collective bargaining agreement. The point was the same, I thought.
Your Honor, the appellant did not make any argument in that fashion other than in the summary judgment reply brief and then again reiterated in these briefs that made some reference to a memo from the League of Minnesota Cities. That was their only kind of connection to tying the grievance to any violation of the law. Instead, it was really based on this is a violation of the collective bargaining agreement, and it didn't implicate the Fair Labor Standards Act at the time or since the briefing has happened.
Let me take you to something in the district court's opinion that I found difficult, and I'll let you, and your brief supports this conclusion. The district court concluded that, I'm on page 13 of the district court's decision, getting a negative performance evaluation or having a disciplinary consequence rescinded and replaced by a reprimand do not constitute penalty or materially adverse employment action. And here's the reason given by the district court. These are not the kind of consequences which would deter or dissuade a reasonable employee from making a report. And I'll tell you, there's two problems I have with that. Just on the face of it, that seems inconsistent with what a jury might determine, that in fact, an employee might decide, I'm not going to make a report if it's going to end up that I'm going to be punished by getting a reprimand. I'm going to have a record of misconduct in my file. The other concern I have with it is just as a matter of law. As I understand the statute, as to what constitutes an actionable circumstance is what penalize. Penalize means conduct that might dissuade a reasonable employee. So it's a relatively low standard to prevail, which makes it an even lower standard to get to a jury. So how do you defend the district court's decision or reasoning that a reasonable employee might not, it's essentially not even plausible that a reasonable employee will be dissuaded from making a report of a violation of law if the consequence is going to be a written reprimand or a negative performance evaluation.
Your Honor, I also think that speaks to the appellant's first argument about that the district court kind of applied the wrong standard and should have applied the Burlington Northern standard. But what I want to really be clear about and what is highlighted in the briefs is that all of the case law that I've cited interprets that Burlington Northern standard, which is what the appellant is saying that we should interpret, which is that broader definition of something that may dissuade an individual from filing a complaint or something like that. So I'm already working within that. And even applying that standard, whether we're talking about Title VII or the cases that have been decided on the Minnesota Whistleblower Act since that time, have applied that there needs to be a material adverse disadvantage in this case.
Put it more specifically, might a reasonable employee be dissuaded from making a complaint, filing a grievance, making a report of a violation of law if the consequence is I'm going to be reprimanded. I'm going to have a personnel evaluation, a performance evaluation that is negative as the result of my actions. Are you saying that a reasonable employee might not be dissuaded?
Your Honor, I think the case law clearly establishes that that is what the case law states, and in many of those cases, the court did grant summary judgment to the employer. And that is what the courts have said repeatedly in the cases cited in my brief, that it's an objective standard also.
Have you found a case that reaches that conclusion with language like exactly like the penalized definition? in Minnesota statute?
Your Honor, to be fair, I don't think there is an exact case decided on the Minnesota Whistleblower Act since the amendments that did change that definition. But I think that the broader issue is, even if we assume that that is true, that that's an adverse employment action, that in this case, the appellant very clearly, as a matter of law, has not established the city's reasons for its actions are a pretext for retaliation. And I think that's, the court doesn't really need to get into
each of these.
Let's
talk about pretext.
Certainly.
That's another part that troubles me.
Okay.
So as I understand it, the rational, non-discriminatory, non-retaliatory basis for the administrative leave is there needs to be an investigation into these the internal affairs investigations. And that's plausible up until the point where the investigation ends and the sergeant remains on administrative leave for months after that. Why isn't that evidence of pretext, that if your client really was motivated to put the sergeant on administrative leave, why can't we conclude that that must be false if the basis for the leave evaporated but the leave didn't?
Your Honor, there are three reasons that are legitimate and non-retaliatory why that leave lasted as long as it did. The first is there was some turnover happening at the time that there was the deputy or the director, public safety director, was retiring and there was a change in leadership. That's the first reason. The second reason is that the parties were discussing an early retirement buyout, and that's evidenced by Exhibit 27.
So what? I didn't understand. I don't understand that theory. They're talking about an early buyout. What? So put him back in the job. I don't understand why the buyout has anything to do with the extension of leave. And if you could answer your question, if I see your time has expired, but if I'd like you to answer the question in this context. As I understand it, it wasn't just that the sergeant was told you're on administrative leave, but as happens in these cases from time to time, the agency decides that we're going to give you a specific assignment. We're assigning you to be at your house in your working hours. And you can't leave your house because that's your assignment. So essentially, he's on house arrest for months. Now, I'd like you to answer the question in the context of the nature of the administrative leave or correct my factual understanding of the nature of the leave.
I would be happy to, Your Honor. I think that that second reason explaining it and to answer your question directly is the third reason. And the third reason is, as the undisputed record shows, is that his team was performing well while he was out. And obviously that investigative report, which is undisputed, had revealed that he had significant and longstanding violations of department
policy.
Which team? The team that he had, the four patrol officers
that he supervised.
That he supervised.
But he wouldn't be supervising if he was on administrative or if he was on administrative sergeant duties.
What I was going to add, Your Honor, is when the city realized that his team was performing well in light of the investigation, that was why the city employer did not want to bring him back, especially while they were discussing a retirement
buyout. The investigation that ended months earlier.
That is correct, Your Honor. And at no time did he or the union object to that leave or to the terms of that leave.
Okay.
I have nothing further unless the court.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. I want to start with the first issue that respondent addressed with respect to the PELRA issue. I think that issue is easily resolved by the Bliss case. It was a Minnesota Whistleblower Act case. It was a case I handled where the defendant made the exact same argument that the city makes now. The court found that there's no requirement when analyzing a Minnesota Whistleblower Act to actually interpret the contract. The question is whether the defendant retaliated against the employee for the protected conduct. The city provides no explanation as to why it's supposedly inextricably intertwined with the CBA. It just says it with no analysis. The question is whether the defendant or whether Sergeant Moore engaged.
PELRA is intended to provide additional rights exclusive of the Whistleblower Act and vice versa.
Correct. And that's why the language of both of those statutes say exactly that. Moving on to the next issue. Regarding the what the court brought up with respect to the negative performance review, whether that would dissuade a reasonable employee If you look at the Kim case, which dealt with was the systematic kind of adverse employment action, one of the things they referenced in that case was negative employment reviews itself. And the court analyzed that circumstances as a whole to determine that it was an adverse employment action. There are also a couple cases from the Eighth Circuit in that respect.
Were you able to find statutes, cases that analyze statutes identical to the penalized provision of the Minnesota Whistleblower Act?
I did not find, other than general Title VII cases post-Burlington, analyzing the dissuade a reasonable employee, which kind of mirrors. I haven't found anything that specifically references the word penalize and analyze that specifically. I think the court can look to those Title VII cases and understand that it's the totality of the circumstances that you look at and whether a specific alleged adverse employment action qualifies under the statute is based on that statute. And I think it's pretty clear that the Minnesota Whistleblower Act language is much broader than Title VII. It includes additional enumerated or prohibited acts, as well as this penalized provision, which includes and it sort of incorporates this Burlington standard. And I want to turn to the final issue with this. The court kind of hit this nail on the head with respect to the administrative leave. Here are the facts. For 25 years, Sergeant Moore worked at the City of New Brighton as a police officer, largely without incident. He was promoted, he was relied upon as a trainer, he was respected amongst his peers. For 25 years, the city never took any adverse action against him, never reassigned him, never so much as coached him or counseled him. For 25 years. And then in March of 2015, he files the protected union grievance. In the span of 12 months, they charged him with two separate conduct violations. They impose an administrative leave that lasts 9 months. They start two internal affairs investigations, and they hire outside counsel to conduct both, which Director Jacobson admitted was the first time he had ever done that, hired outside counsel to do the administrative or the
investigation. That doesn't cut either way, does it? I mean, you hire outside counsel to make sure that you have an objective investigation that isn't based upon the bias of internal affairs officers in a small department. That isn't cut in your client's favor.
Well, if you draw the reasonable inferences in his favor, you could argue that they did that because they wanted to find something wrong.
If they wanted to find something wrong, they would do the investigation themselves. I don't understand how hiring outside counsel, unless you can show that outside counsel was hand-chosen because counsel is likely to find in favor of a violation.
Well, that's
you have stronger arguments. I saw that in your brief, and I don't see that as saying one thing one way or the other. In fact, I see it cutting the other way.
Well, the record actually establishes that Director Jacobson sent an email to the outside investigator saying, here are the two policy violations that I think were violated. Those were the exact same two violations, policies that were violated.
That's what you do. Internal affairs, I mean, you don't hire an investigator in the vacuum and say, go on a fishing expedition. The federal government does that once in a while, but police departments tend to say, these are the violations we're concerned about. Investigate to determine whether there were violations, find facts, and reach conclusions.
And that's just a broader sort of issue when you look at all the circumstances. And I think what the court alleged to in the sense of him staying on leave for 9 months and then immediately upon his return, getting the negative coaching and counseling, getting the negative review, and then being reassigned.
Can you, I think, your time's up, but may I ask one, just a
absolutely.
Fact question?
Sure.
I suggested maybe it was a reference in your brief to house arrest, and I know that from time to time this is done, that an agency, rather than having the political appearance of a paid vacation and the negative morale issues, it's a common thing for municipalities to say, well, you're still a police officer, you're on administrative leave, but you can't go on vacation unless you take vacation time, so we need to be able to find you, and so your house is where you'll be. What were the facts in this case that support your representation that this is a house arrest? What were the specific directives to Sergeant Moore?
He had to be in his home from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Monday through Friday. That's what he was required to do. And that lasted for 9 months when it should have lasted a much smaller amount of time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the arguments and briefing. The case is submitted. That concludes the court's oral calendar this morning.